The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
Hello. For decades, the Master of Fine Arts degree has quietly dominated the American literary scene. There are now over 100 programs where professors and students go about the business of turning dreams into fiction through the alchemy, or as some would say, the meat grinder, known as the writing workshop. It's a phenomenon like no other in the history of literature. What goes on at these MFA programs? What good comes out of them? And what impact are they having on contemporary American literature? The president of the Literature Supporters Club joins us for a discussion of MFA programs today on the History of Literature.
Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor. And they're delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Okay, so we're going to post this on the 4th of July, which I thought is fitting because our topic today is really about the state of American letters in some sense. And Mike, you have an MFA, I have an MFA. Let's share some thoughts, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I will let you go first.
So I was thinking that MFA programs have gotten pretty darn hard to get into. I was reading an article about MFA programs, and I always say the New York Times is about 6 months behind anything that's interesting or hip, or so.
Right.
So they had an MFA article that I read, and they said that last year Iowa Writers Workshop, which is probably considered the most famous MFA, the best MFA program in the world, in the U.S. Sorry, we'll get to U.S. versus Europe, but they had 1,300 applicants for 50 slots.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I wonder if that's kind of like college applications where just the internet and the ease of finding things out and applying makes the numbers of applicants increase. Although certainly there do seem to be a lot more people going to get MFAs. I've got some statistics here that will really put this in perspective. So it's MFA programs founded by decade. So in the 1920s, there were zero. In the 1930s, there was one, which was Iowa. 1940s and 1950s, there were zero.
And then in the 1960s, there were 11. 1970s, there were 11. 1980s, there were 27. So up to this point, through the end of 1989, we were at 50 round total. And then in the 90s, when I got my MFA and people were already talking about things just being saturated and there were too many programs and there weren't enough good professors and students to fill that many programs, et cetera, there were 41 launched just in the 90s. In the 2000s, there were 94. And so far in the 2010s, we're on pace to have 132 new programs this decade. So they really are ballooning. So the idea that, you know, a single program, you'd think they would all be scrambling to get applicants, and maybe some of them are. But certainly those people who aren't getting into Iowa have a lot of other choices of places to go.
Yeah, I was going to say that programs are selective, but I wonder if they're selective enough, because another statistic I came across is that 4,000 people last year graduated with an MFA.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk about, well, let me jump into my first thing, and then we can maybe talk about some of the features of the MFAs and get to the impact that we think they're having. So, and my first thing that I jotted down was the reason why I went. And what happened was, like a lot of people, I probably fell in love with literature at some point in my childhood or as a teenager, or I don't know when exactly it happened. I always loved to read. And then you make this transition where you think, oh, I would really enjoy writing, and I think I could be a writer. And you kind of take that step. And then I looked around and I looked at all of my heroes and what they did when they were, you know, 20 or 22. And a lot of them had a sort of apprentice phase. Mm-hmm. And they would find, depending on the culture, you know, some cultures it was going to work at a publishing house and you meet authors that way. Some people would work at a newspaper. That was kind of the biggest one for Hemingway and Fitzgerald in that generation that we looked at. They would, you'd go to work at a newspaper and you'd find other writers there. In some places it's, you know, patrons or letters of introduction. And for us, and this is in the 90s, I looked around and said, you know, where are people finding other writers, real writers, professional writers, published writers, writers who are willing to be mentors? And it was really just in the MFA program. That was kind of the only place where I could see where you could just find somebody and hitch yourself to them and learn at their feet for a couple of years and see what the business was all about. And, you know, I did have a list here. I made a list of things that MFA programs are bad at and things that they're good at and things that they are sometimes good at and sometimes not good at. And when I was thinking about this first topic of why I went, which was, you know, looking around and looking for mentors, I thought of all the things that MFA programs are bad at, because I don't want to suggest that MFA programs are any sort of key. You know, every time I think about the positive aspects, I think, well, there are some misconceptions and we should probably try to dispel some of those. So obviously, well, oh, go ahead.
Maybe before you get into that, Jack, you should talk about, in case people are not familiar with an MFA program, you know, maybe just briefly go over like what the workshop is.
Right. So this was a, excuse me, this was an interesting question that I was going to put to you, is whether you think there is such a thing as an archetypal workshop, since these MFA programs are really revolve around the workshop. And I'll go ahead and posit one and you tell me if you think I'm getting some of the details wrong. But I think generally, the most common form of a workshop is 10 or 12 students, maybe a group about that size, who have an instructor. The instructor is a professor. And one of the students or a couple of the students will submit stories that week to discuss. And then maybe the professor will come in and maybe talk a little bit about craft, or maybe give maybe a writing exercise or something, or talk about, sometimes, you know, my professors would talk about a famous short story or a poem that they wanted to go over, something like that. And then we would jump in, and everyone would have read the story in advance, or the poem if you're in a poetry workshop. They would have read it in advance, and then basically the point of the workshop is you are offering criticism or you know, constructive criticism or feedback of some sort. And together, you know, the author usually sits there listening to other people talk about what the story means or what they got from the story, and some suggestions for how they would fix things, or, you know, maybe a more harsher critique than that. You know, this doesn't seem like your heart is really in this, or this doesn't seem like what you should be writing about. And then the author sort of absorbs all that criticism, and people maybe give them him or her written comments as well. And then maybe the professor might weigh in with some sage words of advice and maybe a critique of his or her own of the story. And then that's that person's week. And then the following week, you go on to the next person in the class.
Yeah, that's a pretty good description. I would say that there tends to be there's a strong tendency to be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally you get somebody who's critical, and I feel like the thing about a workshop is it not only is the person who's writing is being critiqued, but anyone who says anything opens themselves up to critique, mm-hmm. which I found to be very strange.
That's right.
The kind of side battles.
Yeah, people really turn on each other, and they sort of say, you know, they will defend the author, or they will say, well, right. I disagree with what, you know, this person said. And then it ends up being about people's ability to criticize or to offer any sort of valuable advice.
Right. So two things stand out for me when I think of a workshop is the idea that you could take 30 pages of someone's writing,
mm-hmm.
and just tear it apart.
Right.
So the way I like to think of it is just take 30 pages of, you know, Dead Souls by Gogol.
Right.
And read it and just be like, did that blow you away? Maybe. Mm. Maybe a part of it would, but maybe you would find ways to say, you didn't tell me enough, which is, you know, a very common workshop comment. Or I really like this person, but then I wasn't very, you know, I didn't feel as much sympathy as I did at the start.
Yeah, right. I lost interest, or I thought it started slow, or yeah, you really could take 30 pages. And in fact, I'm jumping ahead to my, I think I had this as number three, but I had this really unusual experience where, you know, I had a workshop and it was the same group of people, and we met, you know, three semesters in a row. And so by the end of it, you really have heard you feel like you can anticipate each other's comments. And so one of the things we did to break it up, and I think this was actually the workshop's idea, is we thought for the beginning part of the session, what we should do is take turns bringing in something that everyone would read. Like you could bring in, you know, a story by Kafka or something, and then we would all start out and we would be talking about that. So we weren't just talking about each other's work all the time.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, I thought so. And then somebody made the comment as we were talking about whether or not we should do this. Somebody said, well, we're all just going to bring in stuff that everybody loves. Nobody's going to take any chances. Everyone will just bring in all the safe people to bring in. And so we went around the room and somebody said, well, who would a safe person be? And then they said, well, you know, like everyone will just bring in Kafka. And then there was a guy who said, you know, I've never liked Kafka. And, you know, somebody else said, oh, well, you know, Chekhov, we'll bring in Chekhov. Everyone will just bring in a Chekhov story. And then someone else is like, you know, I've never really liked any Russian authors. And we kind of spent, you know, the next 10 minutes or so trying to find a writer that everyone in the class could agree on.
Right.
And, you know, you're trying Jane Austen and Alice Munro and Junot Diaz and Ralph Ellison. And, you know, who could object to these people? Tolstoy, you know, but we could not find an author. There was always somebody who said, just never gotten into that person, and, you know, and so I don't think anybody was trying to, you know, I think everyone was being sincere. I don't think anyone was trying to sink the project or anything. Uh-huh. And I remember sitting there thinking, well, what chance does my story have of, you know, gaining unanimous consent when, you know, we've named every conceivable person and nobody is 8 for 8. You know, if Toni Morrison is not 8 for 8, then what's my story? You know, and it really kind of makes you think, and this can be a good thing or a bad thing. For some people, that could really destroy your confidence because you're going to bring things in and there will just be people who don't like it. And other people will say, well, you know, that's the good thing about an MFA program is it will thicken your skin, that a workshop teaches you how to absorb criticism, which you're going to get if you keep at this. You'll get rejections, you'll get bad reviews, you'll get people who don't like your work. And the MFA is a good place to start training yourself to be able to absorb that.
Yeah, I had a teacher. I would say on balance, all of my teachers were just extremely into hand-holding the students. But I had one teacher who is kind of a prick, and he said the workshop is to the most important thing of workshop is rejecting 90% of what people say, and figuring out which 10% you should listen to. Because he said if you actually listen to what everyone was saying, your work would be horrible, because it would just be just contradictory.
You'd
be listening to the person on the left and then the right.
Yep. And some people say make it shorter, and some people say make it longer. That's exactly right.
So his class was hilarious because instead of going around and people kind of like, you know, being afraid to be honest, I find that, and maybe, you know, you shouldn't be that honest. I mean, writing is a very vulnerable thing to do. But he used to sometimes say, yeah, that story, I think you should put it away and just start a new story.
Right.
And I think that's what sometimes needs to be said. You know, we shouldn't be, you know, fumbling about trying to make sense of these characters if we just, you know, think the person has a better story in them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's hard because for every example of that, you get another example where you think someone is saying that and they're just wrong. You know, it's even with the teachers, even the professors who are the gurus, their opinion is their opinion. You know, they don't always see the merits of a story. And in particular, I think this is maybe not so clear to people who come to a workshop all the time. And, you know, they're very tilted toward literary fiction and maybe literary fiction of a certain kind. And if somebody comes in and they're writing in maybe a broader style, let's say, like a Stephen King, you know, if that's the kind of fiction you love to read and love to write, you know, it's the good professors will take that on their own merits and say, what is the story trying to do? And understand that different genres will work in different ways. But if you're just somebody who's maybe on the edge and you're kind of writing in that middle ground, sometimes those people just get hammered in workshops. And then you think they're probably actually could be the most successful of anybody here, you know, in terms of being able to sell books.
Yeah, I remember a couple of workshops at the end where somebody got just torn apart. And afterward, I heard somebody going over to that writer and saying, you know what? I think your stuff is amazing.
Yeah.
And I just thought that really sums up workshop.
Right.
There was one person who's, you know, the writing really touched that person.
Yeah. So let me go through my knots.
Okay.
And this is just what's the word when you're, these are straw men arguments. I just don't want anyone to, either if they're applying to workshops, think, you know, maybe I want everyone to go in with their eyes open, but also I just want to get this out of the way so that people don't criticize this episode by pointing out some things that I think are fairly obvious if you really think about it. So getting an MFA is not a guarantee of publication. It's not even necessarily the best way to find agents or publishers. You can do all of this outside of a workshop. There's nothing magical about a workshop or nothing required or mandatory about a workshop. It is maybe not even it's certainly not the only way to find like-minded students, or maybe not even the best way to do so, especially in the internet age. I think people can probably form writing groups and critique groups and things like that and find people who share their interests and share their sensibilities. It might be easier to do that than to apply to an MFA program and kind of take the luck of the roll of who's going to be in the class with you. It's not great at career development, finding jobs. And, you know, I kind of thought when I got there that there would be this whole pipeline of jobs where people would, you know, that the university would have this sort of structure in place where they would think, well, everybody who's graduating from here, maybe there aren't going to be tenure track professor jobs for everyone, but there will be publishing jobs or advertising jobs or jobs for creative people or writer, you know, jobs for people who write or tech writing or, and there really wasn't that, you know, the professors mm-hmm. just kind of threw up their hands and said, well, you know, you're kind of on your own. What did you do before you came? And the last thing I have, which is a common critique, and Juno Diaz has really brought this to the forefront, especially recently, is it's not a good place. Like I said, it's sort of the luck of the draw who you get, and it's not necessarily a good place to find a wide diversity, either mm-hmm. among the fellow students or the types of writing. It can be, you know, tilted toward the upper middle class, and it can be tilted toward college graduates who went to, you know, fairly elite schools for undergrad. And I take all of that as, you know, a real caveat for people who are thinking of attending is it might be a real issue for people if you're in there with a group of people who are not only disinclined to like your fiction, but, you know, sort of would never extend themselves to like the kind of things that you're writing about.
Yeah, I'll play devil's advocate and just say that it was two of the happiest years of my life. And I think if you have the money or you can go to a fully funded program, there are a number of fully funded MFA programs, which basically means they don't accept you unless they can give you a full scholarship.
Right.
And so, you know, there are people at my MFA program who kind of drove me insane.
Mm-hmm.
And there were probably about three or four people who I've stayed in touch with whose writing I liked, but also who I just got along with. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I agree that it's getting easier to meet people, but there's something about the extension of college. It's a weird kind of extension of high school and college, I would say, because you don't have that much homework.
Right.
Yeah. You can go shoot pool. You can go drinking.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're getting into my list of good things. I think they are good at getting you to carve out time or to focus on writing. They're good at giving people opportunities to teach, to see if people like that, whether it's as a graduate student assistant or as a lecturer or other ways. It's good at, I think it can be beneficial for some people to really commit themselves to it and come out of the closet, so to speak, maybe to their friends and family and establish themselves and say, this is something that is really important to me and it's something I want to do. And it's like you're suggesting, it's good to just spend time in a university setting. There's other courses you can take and other disciplines and interesting people to meet. And there's a lot of time for, you know, sitting around the table with the beer flowing and talking about important things. And it is kind of an extension of college, which is can be a very positive thing. And then there is something good about getting that MFA. It's an actual degree. It's a thing that goes on your resume. I guess there are probably some people who have to conceal it a little bit if they go into a profession where an MFA is viewed as, you know, sort of a diversion or is not valued. But for most people, I think it's a way of, I mean, I've always found it to be an interesting line on my resume that people want to ask me about, and they think it's, you know, a positive thing, and it shows that I had the discipline to go get the MFA and to get accepted somewhere. And for a lot of people, it was something that they had maybe always wanted to do or thought about maybe doing or know someone who did. And it does qualify you to teach or pursue other things. It's an actual degree. There's some value to that.
I think the benefits of teaching, I was surprised to read how many writers improved their writing after they became faculty at different MFA programs. I thought that was an interesting little quirk.
Yeah.
That, you know, it helped their, like, I was surprised Philip Roth and John Cheever, Louise Gluck and mm-hmm. John Berryman, all these writers and, you know, and poets who really got something out of having to deal with student writing.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things. It might give you a stronger detector for the cliche or the easy thing. You know, if you read 25 stories four times a semester or whatever it is, and, you know, you get into the hundreds and hundreds of stories and you see a very common way to start a story or a common way of describing something, and it might sharpen your antenna for rooting out things in your own writing that would be the obvious choice or the easy choice.
And the flip side to that is whether a writer would have succeeded anyway.
Right.
Sometimes when I think of MFA programs, I do agree that they can help you concentrate and focus and develop skills. But the question, it begs the question, are the skills already there?
Right. Know? Yeah. I heard one professor when I was at the MFA program, he was talking to a friend's daughter who was thinking of applying, and she said, you know, do you think I should go to an MFA program? And he said, only if you have to, like, if you can at all do this without going to an MFA, then go ahead and do it. But if as a last resort. And I thought, well, great, you know, here I am, like, in the middle of my program. But yeah. There is something to that. I mean, you know, if anyone can earn a living as a writer, and, you know, there's certainly no reason why you need to get an MFA to learn how to write. If you're writing and you're writing well and you're publishing what you're writing and you're making money and you have enough time to do it and all of that, the MFA mm-hmm. is not going to give you any secrets that you don't get when you just open up your favorite authors and just start reading.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that Junior Diaz has been critical of MFA programs because he has one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard criticism from T. Corcassian Boyle. He also has an MFA from Iowa, and mm-hmm. he says that the ideal MFA program would be a room that's locked, and the student is in there writing stories, and there are two slots. The top slot is where the pizza goes in, and the bottom slot is where the stories come out.
That sounds horrible. It sounds like industrial farming or something, where you're pumping chickens full of full of steroids. Instead, it's pumping writers full of pizza and hoping to get the end product. You know, the biggest thing, what it comes down to, I think, for MFAs are the things that I had in the category of maybe. And this is where you're really gambling. So let's say you're going to get an MFA and you accept that, you know, it's not going to guarantee publication. And on the other hand, it is going to give me a couple of years. And you're kind of wondering, well, what's the best I can hope for? I mean, it can maybe be a place where you get some really good advice about your writing, and maybe not. You know, maybe the advice is going to be off target, or maybe it's going to be more. Certainly, there are a lot of people who give up writing after going to the MFA, and it's probably because they didn't click with the people there and they didn't get the right advice. Even the professors, you know, maybe they'll give you good advice and maybe they just won't see the value in your work, or they'll be off target. Maybe you'll find a helpful community with the people around you, and maybe it'll be helpful to you to critique others and to learn how to do that. And maybe not. Maybe you are somebody who should be in a room getting pizza shoved in through a slot. You could probably arrange that for like, I don't know, $25,000 a year. And if you get a sponsorship from Domino's, you can probably even cut that cost down. Maybe it's an affordable way to live as a writer for a couple of years. It depends on your tuition deal. And like you said, if you're getting fellowships, or maybe you have the money where that doesn't matter, or you're saving the money where that doesn't matter. It is, you know, that's another maybe not, because they can be very expensive. And it's also a way to really go into debt. And that's not going to help a writer in the long run if they come out of the program and they're really struggling to make ends meet and having to take jobs that, you know, have a lot of demands on their time and energy. And then the last thing I had was, it might be a good thing that MFA programs employ writers and give them time to write. So I'm talking now about the faculty and the professors. And this is really where we're getting into the impact on American letters, because I think it is a big deal that there are all of these students going out to get MFAs and all of that. But really, I think if we look at what impact is this MFA regime having on American literature, you really have to also look at the MFA machine is employing a lot of published authors, especially in literary fiction. And I don't blame them for taking these jobs, because what else is there? There aren't patrons running around, and literary fiction is, you know, it's like hitting the lottery to sell a book that sells enough copies where you could actually live off of it. So they get a steady job, which is at the university, and it doesn't make too many demands on their time, and they're valued as an author, and all of that comes with it. But there are pros and cons to that. And I don't know if you have an opinion on what we see from having these hundreds of authors who are all basically doing the same job around the country.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question of what counts as originality. What do we want to see in terms of new fiction? You know, a lot of people love Alice Munro, and
right, she is one of the heroes of the MFA world, I would say.
Yeah, and there's something very surprising about her fiction that I think people can mimic her, but kind of forget to put the surprise in.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of bad Alice Munro imitators out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who get an MFA have, prior to the MFA, either been part of informal writing groups or taken workshop classes. And I took a workshop class with a teacher who has since published, but at the time he was unpublished, which is, you know, just one of those fairly common things now, that a lot of people who are teaching fiction are not even published. But he had a great exercise, which was just to take two pages of your writing and to hone those two pages. And I almost thought that was more, you know, revealing than 30 pages.
Right.
So, because in two pages, I mean, and I thought that was an interesting exercise, because if you take any writer you like photocopy two pages and show it to somebody, I think the person would say, like, I know this writer. I can't place it, but I know this writer.
Right.
And that's what everyone, you know, refers to as their voice. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people in the MFA programs, when they start, they don't quite know what their voice is.
Right, right. They're just, it's hard when you're trying to write something original, but you have all these mechanics to deal with. You know, you have to put a line of dialogue in there and figure out how that's done, and a description of a setting and figure out how that's done, and somehow you need to make everything flow. And you know, I think a lot of people start out writing in the first person. And I think that's probably a way of getting, it's like a shortcut to finding that voice.
Yeah. I mean, I there's a novelist, David Gates, that I like a lot. And I studied with him, and he says that whenever my characters need to get somewhere, I just have them have a drink first. Because it seems to add a certain kind of rhythm. And he says, and if they're already there, but they really should get going, you know, they'll usually smoke some pot.
So. I think it was Laurie Moore's line was something like 90% of fiction is getting your characters into the car. But yeah, and I think, you know, people smoking, you see that in fiction. Now that fewer people smoke, it's taken away the sort of pauses for beats, you know, that just like actors would have used it in the 50s, say, you know, there was a lot of fiction that would use cigarettes as, you know, he stopped and lit a cigarette, he took a drag on a cigarette, you know, and it's a way of giving you that little pause that once you erase that from people's toolbox, that they had to replace it with something else.
I was trying to think of some of the best advice I got when I was getting my MFA. One bit was a teacher said, look at your books on your shelf and see where your last name would fit if you alphabetized your books.
Yeah.
And I was looking at my books and thinking I fall somewhere between Kafka and Kundera. And this teacher was saying, like, imagine the arrogance of you guys thinking you belong on these shelves. Like how ridiculous it is to like squeeze your name. And he said, that's what you're trying to do. That's how hard it is.
One of the things I used to think is, you know, how many people do we read from a particular decade or a particular century even? Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, we think of the Russian authors as being this huge flourishing, but we still only read like maybe six total, you know, from the whole 19th century. And so if you just kind of do the math and you say that there are 2,500 MFA graduates every year and there's, you know, 1,000 or something faculty, or what is it, 5,000 graduates per year. And there's, you know, over 1,000 writers are teaching at these institutions. And you just think, well, 50 years from now, how many of the people will be read if only every generation only has 5 or 10 people? You know, it's, you just have to kind of do the best you can and not let that overwhelm you.
Yeah, I befriended a guy in my MFA program who used to, whenever we workshop somebody and he didn't like the work, he used to turn to me and say, that guy's writing isn't going to be around in 75 years.
Right. But ours will. You and me. Not that guy, but you and me.
He's like, you really think it's going to be around in 75 years? I don't think so. Maybe in a few years, but...
Now here's, since we talked about what I described as the typical workshop, I wanted to also talk about some unconventional workshops. You know, that model is not necessarily the best model, and it's pretty heavily dependent on the quality of the students around you and how they click with your writing. And a lot of conversations can run off the rails. I heard one story that there was a guy who was kind of long-winded in his comments. And so another guy in the workshop bought a stopwatch, like an old-fashioned stopwatch. And every time the guy would start talking, this guy would pull out his stopwatch and click it with his thumb, you know, and then just watch it until the guy stopped talking. And he'd click it again and he'd look at it and make a big show out of it, you know. So some professors, I think, have implemented some unconventional workshops. Joyce Carol Oates, I've heard, only will meet with students one-on-one. She won't meet as a group with her writing class, and students aren't reading each other's work. They're just getting her time one-on-one. I've also heard she's kind of a thief of her students' stories, that she people, you know, she writes so much that people tend to find some of their best work or some of their best ideas or their best characters or the best, not that she's plagiarizing them, but she's sort of taking, she's using their life stories and their backgrounds as grist for her own mill. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I've heard. And then there are some unconventional workshops. Rick Moody has an article, an essay in The Atlantic, where he talks about some of his mentors, and he really advocates for there being more creativity in the types of workshops and the exercises that people do. And he wants to see things kind of split wide open, which, you know, and he has some really unconventional ideas for mm-hmm. things that, you know, like, why don't you come in and say you're only going to read one book that whole semester? Or why don't you do that? You know, I think he, I don't know, I felt a little bit like his essay, he was running out of ideas, so he came up with this idea to cap things off, because I kind of thought those things, maybe they would work and maybe they wouldn't. You know, you could, for every really creative idea, you could imagine it going horribly wrong and not really helping anybody. The worst example I think I've heard, and this is really the only ugly story that I've thought of, is Gordon Lish's workshops, which were famous for a while. Right. Gordon Lish was the Raymond Carver's editor, and he was kind of this young editor at Esquire. And so he would go and teach these workshops. And I mean, if you're, you know, young and desperate to be published, and you have an actual editor of a magazine that's actually publishing fiction, it's a yeah. real power dynamic. And it sounds to me like he kind of abused that power. There's a lot of students who will talk about what a great, you know, guru he was, and how people would read aloud their story, and he would, hardly anyone made it through the first sentence before he would stop them and tell them it was no good, and that he was going to just talk for the next hour about fiction that way. Some people really thrived in that and really enjoyed it, but it also sounds like he was kind of using it to manipulate people, and especially female students in his class. And it just sounds like a nightmare that it was, you know, kind of the power dynamic gone bad. And I think that probably used to happen a lot, and I suppose it probably still does, but it just seems like a really ugly scene to get in when the professors are holding themselves above people who are maybe a little bit fragile, in a fragile state, putting themselves forward with their writing and really eager to hear words of praise from somebody who matters. And that's one of the biggest uglinesses, I think, associated with MFAs.
You look at the number of people who publish who have MFAs, and it's a bit staggering, I have to say. I mean, I was looking at Richard Ford, yeah. Cal Irvine, and you know, Michael Chabon, Alice Siebold at Cal Irvine, Chang Ray Lee, David Foster Wallace, Gary Steingart. I mean, so many really hot, you know, literary writers have come out of MFA programs.
Yeah. Now, that's a pretty diverse group of people in their writing. Do you think there's an MFA style or an MFA cookie cutter pattern or anything that you would attribute to the whole generation?
I wanted to get to that. I find that, because, you know, back to your story about eight people trying to agree on whether they like Kafka, the problem with the workshop is, you know, writing is read in solitude by one person. Normally, even if your spouse and you are reading the same book, you're usually not at the same part in the book, and so your conversations kind of go past each other, and, you know, are complementary mm-hmm. rather than head on. And so the workshop, I think people kind of reach a consensus of right. we need more, rather than saying, is this writing original? Which is sometimes I would try to turn the workshop to that focus, because I thought mm-hmm. that was a far more interesting question.
Right.
You know, is this story different from other stories?
Mm.
And it's a harder question, but it's actually, you know, one that a reader thinks more about.
Right.
You know, not am I getting to know the characters in a rhythm that is convincing and persuasive?
Right.
It's like I read the story, and does it grab me or not?
Yeah. There's a way to sort of bulletproof a story.
Right.
You can avoid risks and make it less susceptible to criticism. And especially if, you know, the writing experience is a solitary one by definition. And when you're writing it and delivering it to the world, the readers are going to be reading it, you know, millions of miles away from you. But it's different if you're writing and you know the eight faces who are going to be reading it, and then you will be sitting and listening to what they have to say about it. And I think it can distort your writing.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the literary landscape of this country, I think there definitely are shifts from, say, the Raymond Carver Hemingway style minimalist fiction to, you know, what I think Franzen calls maximalist fiction, like David Foster Wallace or Zadie Smith. And I think the workshop, there tends to be this generic comment that, you know, this writing is run on and you've kind of lost the point. I don't know who's in the room anymore. And I feel like, you know, those kind of comments can be thrown in Zadie Smith's face.
Right.
You know, and you know, again, it what's the point if you're enjoying the story?
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're submitting, you know, a single story or a single excerpt, and you're anticipating the pencil marks people are going to be writing, it does kind of drive you toward a Raymond Carver type style of, well, let me try to make every word perfect, and I'll just make, you know, I don't have time to do that for a 100-page excerpt, but let me just write a 6-page short story and see if I can just make something perfect and make it, you know, so exquisite and so, well, every word in the right place and everything sharply drawn and every description will be original and every sentence will have, you know, interesting words. And right. you know, as I'm describing it, I'm thinking, you know, it really is, what I'm describing is a very particular type of story.
Yeah. I mean, and going to the substance of it, you know, I remember I had a MFA teacher who was great, and he said, take a look at McSweeney's website, because they actually, I mean, you know, people, I know people who are kind of, it's grading McSweeney's and that whole group, but they have a very funny list of things that your fiction should not include and should include. And I think it should include a factory and it shouldn't include anyone backpacking and it should not, and it should not include any complaints about your mom.
I know a teacher who banned a story. This was, she had been, you know, teaching creative writing at this university for several years, and she banned stories where a guy wakes up the day after the biggest frat party of the year and tries to remember what had happened the night before. She's like, we've seen enough of those. I've had my fill.
Yeah, so I mean, we haven't talked too much about the substance, but when you were saying, you know, like Chang Rui Lee, David Foster Wallace, I mean, their writing is very, very different. And that kind of goes back to my earlier point. Would these people just have succeeded anyway?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe they would have been the exact same writer, but maybe the MFA gave them the time they needed to write or the confidence they needed to write, or it's hard to say, you know. It's hard to say exactly what someone gets out of an MFA.
You look over across the pond at Europe, and in England now,
yes,
there are a fair number of MFA programs sprouting up, but on the continent, MFA programs are looked down upon.
Yeah, because the idea is, well, you can't teach writing. You can't teach creative writing, which is a fair point. I mean, it's true. Like, you can't, you know, if you could, we'd have every year we'd be graduating 5,000 Balzacs. You know, I heard an interesting thing about an MFA program in England that Martin Amis was guest, a professor. He was a guest professor there. They were asking him, you know, well, how is it for you to read all the student work? And he said, I don't read student work. I said, why would we do that? You know, and he said, they said, well, what do you read? He said, well, sometimes I'll read something that I'm writing, and usually we'll just read, you know, something else, and I'll just talk about it. Like, aren't they paying to hear me? Like, why would everyone who pays money for this want to hear what their fellow students have to say? Like, they're paying for me. So I don't know. Maybe it's just an intensely American thing. Maybe it fits our national character somehow. There must be some reason why these things are sprouting up, and they don't seem to be stopping anytime soon. And would you say that overall, if I had to ask you a thumbs up or thumbs down, would you say they're a force for good or a force for bad?
I think if you have the money and you have the time, it's a pretty swell way to spend 2 years.
So I'm going to say that it is that's a sideways thumb. but that's probably where I am too. So let's leave it there. Mike, as the president of the Literature Supporters Club, I can't think of anyone who would be in a better position to discuss MFA programs. And thank you for joining me today on the History of Literature.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, that's going to do it for today's episode. My thanks to Mike, as always, for joining me. We have some good episodes in the works. The next one, Othello. Oh boy, that one's a killer. Aren't you jealous? I am on vacation, posting these episodes through the miracle of 21st century time-traveling technology. Think of me as the sweaty, wide-eyed H.G. Wells character rapping on your door, wearing my leather jacket and aviator goggles, inviting myself into your parlor. You build a fire, and I tell you a wondrous tale. How do you make sure you hear all these wondrous tales? You subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a rating and a review. Then go tell all your friends that they can expect me to. I can visit everyone all at once, like Santa, just like Santa. Hey, speaking of Santa, happy 4th of July. Could I be more off than that? You can see my time-traveling machine has a few glitches. A doohickey where I should have installed a what's-it. All right, that's enough. Othello next week. Oh, and I almost forgot. You can find more at historyofliterature.com or jackwilson.com. That's J-A-C-K-E, wilson.com. You can leave me a message there, or you can write me an email at jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. That's J-A-C-K-E, wilsonauthor@gmail.com. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.